picture.
What date is that? Where? Amador County Board of Supervisors will come to order on this day, April 23rd, 2013. The board has met in closed session, and report from staff was given on all items except for confidential minutes, which will be pulled from the agenda because there are none and heard at a later date considered. The board will go back into closed session after our regular session and continue discussion on item 3A, Buena Vista Rancheria. With that, if you could all stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God. All right, thank you for being here today. And under the first item, agenda, we do have an addendum to the agenda. The Regional Council of Rural Counties report will place that on the agenda as item 9. Item 8, minutes. There are no minutes today, so that item can be scratched from the agenda. With that, can I have approval?
So moved.
Moved by Supervisor Novelli, second by Supervisor Onetto to approve the agenda as amended. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Public matters not in the agenda, discussion items only, no action to be taken. Any person may address the board at this time upon any subject within the jurisdiction of the Amador County Board of Supervisors. However, any matter that requires action may be referred to staff and a committee for report. A recommendation for possible action at a subsequent board meeting. There is a three-minute time limit. Ms. Bragstad, good morning.
Good morning. Susan Bragstad, Amador City. I emailed you about a month ago requesting some help for the farmers market. Our markets are opening in June 2nd in Jackson, and we have high costs, including insurance. We have to pay an $800 corporate tax to the state and many other costs. And I was hoping you could help us with your discretionary funds of chipping in to help us with our insurance. Anyway, I thought, since I got no response from the emails, I thought I'd come and ask you.
You didn't get my response?
No.
I sent it by phone. That could be why you didn't get it. I was on my way to Idaho when you... I got that.
I got your response that you thought it was worth asking. But I
that's as good as gold there. I'm fine with it. I mean, we do it every year, so.
Well, you stopped the last few
did
years.
Did we?
Yeah, you did help us out our first 10 or so years. But it'd be great.
Susan, I'm willing to contribute. The reason why I didn't respond back to you is because we had budget meetings, and depending on which way the budget went, that had a little effect on their discretionary budget. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate anything you're willing to do.
Same with me, Susan. The proposal was to cut our discretionary budgets down to $1,000 a year.
Oh.
Which didn't go very far.
No.
No, I could loan you guys some money, but it's going to be a prime plus.
Well, thank you for anything you're willing to do.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
When every area of the county budget is tight, you have to try and pull
in
all
the past
things together.
Excuse me, it was like 400, was it? Something like that a piece?
It was, okay. Yeah. Our insurance is around 1,600.
Okay.
It was 1,500, but now we have to cover Plymouth, so it's 1,600. So okay. Whatever you can afford.
You were asking for 300, correct?
You That's
were asking
right.
For 3, weren't you?
Well, it used to be 4.
It was 1,488 when I asked you, now it's 1,588.
Yeah, you were asking for 300 from each supervisor, I thought.
That would be great.
Do the cities contribute any to could that
No, but we have to cover them with our insurance. And hopefully they don't charge us for a business license or a permit. And they haven't lately, but no, they don't contribute.
The only unincorporated area that gets the benefit is Pine Grove, isn't it?
Unincorporated, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think the cities should...
Not a bad idea.
...feel like contributing, too, especially since Jackson is the big dog on the TOT scale.
Yeah. No, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Well, you can count on me. I'll get the paperwork started today.
Great. Thank you.
Each board member will consider and mail what they can, then.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Susan. Any other public matters? Morning.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Gerlitz. I'm the 4-H Program Coordinator for University of California Cooperative Extension. I'm here to say hello today and let you know that this is the 100-year anniversary of 4-H in California this year, and so we're going to be showcasing that at the fair. And hope everybody gets to make the fair and see what we've got out there, as always. And let's see, what else? I've been the 4-H Program Coordinator in Calaveras for quite some time. I'm replacing Larry Foss in here. So I wanted to say hello, and we're always looking for 4-H leaders, and Brian, I think I've talked to you on the phone. And I think you all get the newsletter that I send out?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, good. So, and thank goodness for Valerie Anderson. She does a great job of helping write that. So, yes, we're always recruiting more leaders and more children in 4-H. I think it's a great program. It's not just livestock. We've got a lot of other things to offer, too. But I do have a livestock background myself. My boys were in 4-H. And I was in FFA in high school. I went to Bret Hart. So any questions of me?
I did my time a long time ago when my kids were growing up. But maybe when my grandkids come around.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. Well,
welcome aboard.
Welcome aboard.
Yeah, well, I've been here. I started in Amador in July, and so I'm not quite a year, but getting grounded. And Larry's been great at helping me with the program, because I was the 4-H program coordinator about 4 years prior to Larry even coming in. So I had to mentor Larry. So when he was on his way out, he got to mentor me as far as how, who's who and all that. So it's been fun. I really enjoyed being here, and just want to say thank you.
Could you make sure you sign in for the record,
okay,
please?
Gotcha.
So we get your name right the first time. Thank you. Any other public matters? Good morning.
Kimberly Pruitt from Congressman Tom McClintock's office. Nice to see you this morning. I wanted to give you a couple of updates on some things that are going on in the district. One is we are in the middle of our congressional arts competition, and we've had over 40 pieces of art submitted by local high school students from all over our district. What it is it's a national competition that each congressional office participates in, and we encourage artistic expression through the high school teachers, the high school art teachers. The students submit their artwork, and right now we're displaying it over at B&I Industries over in El Dorado Hills, right off of Latrobe Road. So we encourage anyone from the public to go and view the art. It's incredible. There's lots of different things, painting, oil, photography, sketches, you name it, and it's just unbelievable. So what we do is we have a panel of judges from all over the district that go and judge the artwork, and then they pick first place, second place, and third place winner, and then we do a reception for all the parents and the students and the teachers and also the judges, and we'll be doing that on May 1st over at B&I. And the winner actually gets to go back to D.C. for the national reception, and their artwork is hung in the Cannon office tunnel for the whole year, along with all the other art pieces of art from all over the country. So it's a really great program. We've been doing it for about 4 years, and we're excited to have Jackson and Amador County involved in that.
Has the judging been done yet, been completed?
They did 3 days of judging. and they completed it over the weekend, and then all the judging sheets are being tallied right now, and then the winners will be announced, I believe, this week. And we'll send out press releases throughout the district. And then the reception's on May 1st, and I encourage any of you from the Board of Supervisors are invited to attend that, and I can send you an email with all the details. And it's right over in El Dorado at BNI Studios, right on Latrobe.
If you could send that to our board clerk, and she could distribute it, that way you don't have to have all of this.
That's great. And then I also want to let you know we're having a teletown hall meeting tonight. Anyone's welcome to attend those. You just go on our website at mcclintock.house.gov to sign up. And it's a really good way to get informed of what's going on currently in D.C. and what's happening on the ground there. We're also having a town hall meeting in Calaveras County on April 30th at the Bret Hart High School at 6 o'clock. And that's open to the public. And I did want to give you a heads up. The Congressman does have a bill that he's introduced that will probably be coming to the floor in the next 2 weeks. It's H.R. 807. It's called the Full Faith and Credit Act. And you can look that up online. It basically says that the federal government needs to prioritize paying down some of the debt before raising the debt ceiling, because that issue is going to be popping up at the beginning of May. So you can look for that. And he's doing a lot of work down in on the Merced River issue, and also some issues going on with Yosemite. He's working on trying to keep the recreational opportunities available to the public. So there's a lot of those kinds of things going on, and I will be here from 10 to 12 doing constituent office hours, so I'd be glad to talk with any of you later if you have any more questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, actually, I'm glad you brought up that. He's worked on the Merced River wild and scenic issues down there. And if a person goes online and looks up the plan they're putting forth, it really gives you kind of like a window into what the Wild and Scenic Act's all about. And it's incredible, the actions that it's pushing down there. So I do appreciate you bringing that up. Also, as far as national debt, I saw something today that was really intriguing. It was talking about that the national deficit, 40% of it is owed to the Social Security Trust Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank system. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. Everybody, it's always what you hear is you think it's owed to China, and basically they were like 8.5% of the national debt. So to them, that was it. So, just
good
food
point.
For thought.
The congressman is probably right in the thick of it. Does he represent Mariposa County too?
No, actually, we have we don't have Mariposa County.
But Merced River issues, though, he's probably well aware of some of the court rulings that have been.
Yes.
Made in Yosemite, where they're just these ludicrous people in that area. Even the park people are up in arms because of what they're trying to make them do.
Yes.
That will have absolutely no impact on the Merced River.
Exactly. Just to go a little bit more into detail with that, they're wanting to take out all commercial activity, all horseback riding, mountain biking, all kinds of. They want to take out a historic bridge,
swimming pool,
skating rinks, and these are things that have been in for years and years and years and years, and it would really affect the local tourism and the history of Yosemite. And so the congressman is standing up for the people down there, and the Park Service actually, even though there was a federal judgment that came down, they gave the Park Service the Park Service, it's in their hands to come up with the plan. So the Park Service, a lot of what's happening is coming from the Park Service, and so there's a little bit of controversy there because they're trying to say, well, the judge said we had to do this. Well, the judge didn't say you had to take out swimming pools, horseback riding, ice skating rinks, and a historic bridge. He said come up with a plan. So the congressman's working with the Park Service to try to come up with a better plan that will make it accessible to the public. And then also extending the comment period because not enough of the public had an opportunity to respond. So he just wrote a letter requesting that comment period be extended another 60 or 90 days.
Is there anything that we can do to help, like a letter of support?
Write a letter of support if the board would like to do that. You know, that would be great. You know, the media is always a challenge because, you know, they're usually not on our side on these things. And so, you know, there's a lot of misinformation being spread that the congressman's trying to commercialize Yosemite. And that's not what he's trying to do. He's just trying to keep those recreational opportunities open to the public.
I mean, they're taxed as it is right now, the recreational opportunities down there. Campsites are crowded. You have to book in advance. So it seems to me if you take away from that, it's going to put more of a strain on it.
Exactly. And, you know, with as you know, with a small these small counties, tourism is a huge driver. And, you know, it's kind of all we have left a lot in these counties because we don't have a timber industry in that anymore. But it very small ones. So the tourism is very important, and so he's just trying to do whatever he can to help in that area.
Ms. Pruitt, one question, please. Tonight's teleconference, is there just the congressman and that's it, or is it voter equalization and someone else? Or
what you do is you call in, and he speaks usually for about 10 minutes, and he'll just kind of talk about the issues that are going on right now in D.C. Last week they had the cybersecurity bill that passed. He actually voted against it, but it passed last week. And there's some other big issues that are popping up in the next few weeks. So he'll probably talk about that. And then the constituents that call in, you go through a screening right where you call and you just tell them what, and they put you in the queue. And then we just go down the list and try to take as many questions as we can, and
okay.
It usually lasts a little over an hour, and some people just like to call in and just listen, but if you want to make a comment, you can get in the queue. And
a good resource for the congressman is the current chairman of RCRC, Kevin Kahn, who is a supervisor from Mariposa County, and he worked for Yosemite for years and years,
yeah.
And he is just livid about this because it will change the whole complexion of that park, and
yeah.
You're taking away recreational opportunities,
right,
which is the whole goal of why this lawsuit was started in the first place, is to keep people out of the parks.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's been the goal of the congressman since he got elected in 2009. He got on the Natural Resources Committee because our district, our old district and this district, is vast with natural resources, and his main goal is to get the public land managers to work with, you know, to open more opportunities up instead of shutting them down.
I think they feel stifled now, according to the Park Service representatives there. We just had a conference there, and the ruling that came out of the Circuit Court.
You were right the first time.
Yeah. Has to be opposed. They have to get a contrary ruling from another court. So they're trying to follow down that pathway, but at some point, how much do you spend on litigation?
Exactly. And that's where, you know, we're encouraging the federal agencies to actually stand up to, because the lawsuit doesn't say a specific plan. It just says you need to have a plan. And so we're encouraging the federal agencies, like the Park Service and the Forest Service, to start, you know, standing up and saying this is what we think is best. And so, you know, they do have the right to do that. Sometimes it's just easier to not do that, but they do have the right because that's what the public demands. So I think it's going to turn out to be a good result. I just think it's going to be very controversial the next year or two.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, it's interesting that you bring up the point of the lawsuit does not require them to, you know, remove skating rinks and campgrounds, but to have a plan. That is the same position that this board and this county has taken in our negotiations with the Forest Service regarding the travel management plan and the recent lawsuit that caused them to have to initially close 42 different off-highway vehicle routes in and around the El Dorado National Forest. We're requesting, now the Forest Service found that 24 of those 42 routes were not impacting meadows in any way, shape, or form, so those were reopened. But the remaining 18 routes did show some level of impacts to the meadow areas that the trails and roads went through, in spite of the fact that many of those trails and roads were historic and, in fact, traveled by the wagon trains. But to that end, we have asked that the plan submitted by the Forest Service be just that, the adoption of a plan to do the environmental work and come up with the mitigation measures necessary to mitigate those effects on the meadows and be able to eventually continue to place those routes on the travel management list, but not to close those routes until the mitigation measures are done, but to your point, adopt the plan, specify within the plan how the process is to be carried out so that those roads and trails can remain open during the time that the Forest Service is complying with the required mitigation measures.
Exactly, because once you close those roads, reopening those roads, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So if you can show that you have a plan, and if they can show that they have a plan and they're mitigating, then that should work.
Yeah, it comes down to the definition of implementation, and our position is that implementation of the mitigation measures first requires the planning and the environmental work, but that's all part of the process, and those trails and roads should stay open until mitigation is complete.
Unfortunately, this is a hard political issue for the people that filed the lawsuit, but you have people across every political spectrum that want to keep the park just the way it is right now, and they've enjoyed it for years that way. They want to continue
Absolutely.
To enjoy it. All right, we thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoover, I saw you heading this way.
Swan song?
Is this your swan song?
Well, I'm Tom Hoover, Jackson Valley Irrigation District. I think I'm before you with good news.
You're leaving?
I'm leaving. I know you enjoy that, but no, I am here to give you a quick update. And the first is that end of this month, I'll be done, retired from JVID. So, and on that note, I would like to thank you for all the board and previous boards that have helped me, at least in the water business in Amador County since, 87? Anyway, but the board in Jackson, board of directors, is pleased to announce the appointment of Steve and Frederick to the general manager's position. Steve's been with us for 3 or 4 years working on special projects. He spent a year as operations manager, and so it's a pretty natural fit for him to carry on. He's worked with your departments here quite a bit, so he's a known quantity, comes from the county. I think his grandfather was actually on one of the earliest JVID boards. So we think it's a good fit, and we hope he'll stay for some time. But I just wanted to announce that, let you know that you don't have me to pick on anymore. You're going to have to find someone else.
You want to bring Steve up?
Yeah.
If you'd like to,
That'd be a good idea.
He needs to get a little more public speaking.
Your last day officially is the end of this month, correct?
That's the 30th.
Congratulations to both of you.
Yeah.
Morning, Steve. Steve Frederick.
Morning, Steve.
New JVID manager, May 1st.
Morning.
You have any questions? I'm excited for the appointment of general manager. I signed a 3-year contract with him, so I'm stuck there for 3 years unless something drastic happens. But I think it's a good fit. Tom said I've been there since 2008, so he was a little off on the math. But I've been working on the treated water project, which is slowly evolving to come to fruition here probably by the end of June, where we'll be able to service treated water to Lake Amador Recreation Area. And then we have a Phase 2 project where we're going to develop a distribution system to get down treated water into the valley. So,
How's that Phase 2 going, Steve? I know you've been working on that a long time.
Yeah, we have 12 months to finish Phase 2. Right now we're in an environmental stage. We still have planning and design to design the pipeline, but it's going. It's been funded. There's no issues.
And is that going all the way to the Oaks?
Yeah, it will go past the Oaks. Initial talks is that it looks like it's going to be a $3 million grant. So how much ever pipe we can get in the ground for $3 million, how far we'll go. But it'll definitely take care of the Oaks.
We appreciate JVID being timely in their repayment of the loans. And, I mean, you've already done a lot of work with me down there and coordinated on that project and looking to future funding. So I'm sure you got an education from Tom. I know you know the system inside and out now. So
yep.
Welcome aboard as official the general manager.
Well, thank you.
On May 1st, correct?
On May 1st.
Hoover, any other comments?
I got one for Mr. Hoover.
Come on up, Tom.
Mr. Hoover and a young lady back then by the name of Helen Guthrie recruited me as a water board member with Upcountry in the COP system back in, I believe it was 89. And so I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Hoover. And if Helen was here, I'd say thank you to her, too. But
we'd only known.
Yeah.
Fair would lead.
Not done yet, Tom. You'll have to come back down and work on one more project with that we haven't finished up yet.
Maybe you can come up.
That'd be okay, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure we wouldn't be opposed to that, but I appreciate all the work you've done over the years. I know I served on the Water Agency Board with you and been involved as the supervisor with JVID on a number of different issues and always easy to work with.
I appreciate all your help. It's been enjoyable. But thank you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Enjoy retirement. I'm sure you work harder than
ever. Yeah, we know what that's like for the next 30 days.
Any other public matters? Supervisor Novelli?
Yes, sir. I just want to tell the chairman and the other board members that Terry Cox and myself and Rich Farrington have been, and Gene Mancebo with AWA have been meeting. We're trying to get some CDBG grant monies possibly for next year to, even though the budget's been cut, but possibly for next year to get these two tanks that we have sitting up at our corporation yard up and running so we could help out the water agency and have water flow throughout the county. We haven't came to any conclusion yet, but we met once and we're going to meet again. The other thing I want to say is that on the veteran side, we have two open houses. We have one coming up on Thursday of May 2nd. It's going to be at the Veterans Hall. It'll be a public outreach at the American Legion Post 108. It'll be from 11 to 3, and the other veterans outreach we're going to have at Broadway and Clinton Road at First 5, and that'll be on May 9th, and that's at 10 o'clock. And that's it, sir.
Thank you. Any other public matters? If not, we'll go into our regular agenda, item 6, Planning Department. Supervisor Plaz, consent agenda. Any items to be pulled? I have a motion then.
Move approval of the consent agenda as submitted.
Second. Moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Supervisor Plass. Now we'll go on the regular agenda. Planning Department, item 6, discussion of possible action relative to a presentation by Sutter Gold Mining Company regarding the results of blast and noise monitoring conducted during the months of January and February 2013. For the Lincoln Mine Project located on Old Highway 49 between Sutter Creek and Amador City.
Mr. Chairman, I'll step down due to a potential conflict of interest. And that is my son's an employee of Sutter Gold.
Thank you. Let the record show Supervisor Boitano stepping down.
Morning, Susan Grohl, the Planning Director. Back in January, February, the county had received several complaints and concerns about the blasting that was coming from the Sutter Gold Mine. The mine has been conducting, or did conduct, blasting and noise monitoring for a couple of months, and they have a presentation where by today they will present the results of that monitoring that was done for the board. We do have members of the public here as well, and some of the people here today were gracious enough to allow the monitoring to occur on their property so that they could get some data that would be reflective of what these people have been feeling. So, Mr. Cochran is here. I'll turn it over to him.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Morning, David.
Morning, Mr. Chairman and fellow board members. My name is David Cochran. I'm Vice President of Environment, Health, and Safety with Sutter Gold Mining. You might recall, and I thank Susan for the introduction, but you might recall when we were here in January, we talked about our on-site monitoring program, wherein, per our use permit, we monitor both vibration and also noise at the project boundary. And with respect to the noise, we monitor both the subaudible component below 20 hertz and also the audible component. During that presentation, we talked about the results and basically with respect to the vibration monitoring, the vibration levels are so low that we do not even record vibrations at our project boundary for many of the blasts. And so in response to the complaints received from citizens in Amador City, we wanted to conduct a study, and we volunteered to conduct a study of noise monitoring of both the audible and the subaudible noise at off-site locations.
Question for you, Mr. Cochran. You're doing a program for noise. Would that also, would you be looking at the air over pressure blast?
Yes, it includes it's called air over pressure, so it includes the low frequency air pressure changes due to blasting that cannot be heard by the human ear, as well as the higher frequency that can be heard. The
reason why I ask that is on page one, third paragraph on the bottom, it talks about, as noted in the blasting program by Reeve and Associates for Lincoln Mine, regular acoustical noise measurements taken for the purpose of monitoring compliance with local noise ordinance almost always use A-weighted dBA scales. Instruments used for these A measurements filter out most of the air overpressure occurring below a frequency of 20 hertz. I think that's hertz, HZ. Because humans cannot hear it and are generally not annoyed by it. And the real meat of it goes on there. Much of the air overpressure frequency spectrum created by rock blasting occurs at frequencies below 20 hertz. So the question I'd have, if you're filtering that out, and that's where most of the air overpressure frequency spectrum comes from, how could you measure it?
We don't use the dBA scale. We use linear dBL, and okay. dBL captures both the subaudible portion and also the audible portion. So it goes down to that lower frequency of, I think the bottom of it is 2 hertz, and a lot of the blasting noise occurs, or the blast effects are between 2 and 20 hertz. And basically they're so low that you don't hear them, but you feel them, much like a gust of wind. So it's a change in the pressures. You don't hear them. You feel them, really. But the range of the instruments that we use also records those higher frequency content or the sound that humans can hear. So our study and our instruments on site record both of those, and those recordings are typically done in the dBL scale rather than dBA, which just filters out those lower frequency.
So that DBL, that's a linear?
linear, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the same question I had, too. Is that the DBL, then, is more sensitive than the DBA?
It just measures over a broader range of frequencies. So DBA looks at the audible frequencies. And this is the one that you're most familiar with because most of your sound ordinances and the general plan requirements are all focused on the DBA, and that's the noise that people can hear. With blasting, a lot of the effects are below those hearing levels, and so it wouldn't be fair if we just measured that higher frequency content.
Well, as it says on page one, and it talks about just what you talked about, your sensitivity, what you can hear, perception of loudness. The A-weighted sound level has become the standard tool of environmental noise assessment, but you used a standard higher than that with a DBL?
Basically, most of your ordinances will talk about DBA, and the DBL is what we use to capture both the subaudible portion of the effects of blasting as well as the audible portion. So it covers a broader range of frequencies.
It covers a broader range, but it covers them to the level of the DBA, of what it would cover?
Well, yeah, it captures the higher frequencies that are included in DBA, and then it also captures the lower frequencies that are changes in air pressure that cannot be heard by the human ear.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, to that point, I'd call attention to the page 4 of the description of blast noise, where it says that your meters that you used, number one, I guess, were microphones. To me, that indicates the measurement of noise rather than vibration. And secondly, a couple bullet points down from that on page 4, it says the meters were programmed to report A-weighted and linear peak sound pressure levels. So did they capture both the DBAs and the DBLs?
Yes, they capture both, and they do not capture the vibrations, which you record with a seismograph.
And do we have any reporting on that?
The purpose of this study was to look at the noise component, because the vibrations are so low at our property boundary that it's not scientifically possible for them to propagate to the distances at Amador City, where the complaints came from.
The effects of the blasting seem to be felt by people in December, January?
Yeah, we started blasting in September with two new portals, so we were actually starting very near the surface, and we worked our way back, and we started getting complaints in the December time frame. And so in response to those complaints, we did a presentation in January, you might recall, that summarized the blasting for 2012 and looked at the complaints. And basically, the conclusion of that presentation was that the folks were hearing and feeling the blast effects in Amador City because of transient atmospheric or weather conditions. When you have very cold temperatures and high humidity, sound waves travel through the air. It has less resistance. In addition, you can get inversion layers that help to focus these waves at distances typically between 1 and 3 miles away.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves talking about the future and next December, so maybe we ought to let you go ahead and go into your presentation before we have questions, more questions from us and the public.
Okay, yeah, because I think you guys have taken up my allotted 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it's 3 minutes, but no, go ahead.
Okay, moving right along. If you could have the next slide, please. So basically after the last meeting, the company retained Ballard Acoustical Consultants. They're experts in basically, and is that too big, Ted? You look like
small.
It's too small. I can't see it.
Too big. Are you serious? Actually, it might help Jennifer. Dim those lights a little bit here, maybe.
That's better, Susan.
Well, it's good for me. I don't know how it is.
I can see it.
I could see it at the other level, but that's...
You got the wrong glasses.
So we retained Ballard Acoustical Consultants. They're expert in monitoring noise, and they were actually one of two consultants that the county considered and received proposals from to do the county, implement the county's monitoring program. The county hired another consultant, and we hired Ballard for this study. And the purpose of it was to comply with mitigation measure 43.4, which requires us to investigate and respond to complaints. Ballard's scope of work was to monitor both the ambient noise level as well as blast air overpressures. And we chose to monitor at the site and at four residences. Three of the folks who had complained about noise monitoring were generous enough to let us monitor at their property locations. And we also added another monitoring station in Sutter Creek where the county had used for their baseline noise studies. We wanted to make sure that we monitored a sufficient time interval to capture both varying weather conditions and also to monitor a significant amount of blast activity on different levels in the mine. So we captured blasting on several of the different levels, and I'll show you a slide that summarizes that in a minute. Then their scope of work included compiling and evaluating those results along with the results of our blast logs, which document where each shot occurred, what time it occurred, and the amount of explosives. And then they also took data from our automatic weather station that we also installed in January at the mine site. So it records automatically temperature, barometric pressure, humidity, wind speed and direction, and many other factors. And then the last was to present the report, which we submitted to the county and provided copies to the participants in the study last week. I'm going to go through the findings at the start and then kind of walk through some of the data at the end. But basically, the blast data that were logged at the residence was well below the allowable threshold in our permit for daytime blasting, which is 133 dBL, and that is applied typically at our property project boundary. Peak overpressures measured by Ballard confirmed Sutter Gold's monitoring of air overpressures. Many of the blast events were not audible in Sutter Creek and Amador City at peak overpressures higher than the mine's allowable nighttime blast limit. And the blast logs maintained by Amador City residents and conversations with the residents, as well as Ballard's observations in the field, indicate that some blasts were audible, but a greater percentage, depending on the site, between 53 and 70%, could not be heard at those locations. The highest recorded levels in Amador City occurred, as we expected, during periods of both cold temperatures and high humidity. And with the warming of the weather and the dropping of the humidity, or the raising of dropping of humidity, the audibility of those blasts should diminish over time. None of the peak overpressures that we measured exceeded thresholds which could cause damage to structures, which is about 150 dBL. A common comment made by residents towards the end of the study, according to Ballard, was that sound levels seemed to have tapered off significantly. And lastly, blasting noise was measured in only 0.4% of the logged intervals. So basically, there are over 37,000, I believe, time intervals measured, and only 0.4% of those contained blast events. And commonly, the events were either not measurable because they were too low, or they were substantially lower than the maximum noise levels from other sources other than the mine. This slide just basically kind of sets the scene. Amador City is up here. Sutter Creek, the northern tip is down here. Our mine site is right here. This is old Highway 49. The bypass over here, and this is our mine site, and that's Ice House Pond. The three sites in Amador City were located at distances of anywhere from 4,100 to 6,200 feet approximately from the mine. Site A, which is located on our property, was set up basically where some of you came and observed a blast back in January, and from that location by the trailer, that's where we set up that monitoring station approximately. And then Site 4 is at a, as I said earlier, that was at a location in Sutter Creek where the county did some baseline monitoring. Next slide, please. This slide just kind of shows that we recorded 97 blast events during the study. About 62 of those were in February, and the difference was in January. This top part of the chart basically shows what hours of the day blasting events occurred. Most of our blasting occurs at end of shift between the hours of 4 and 5. Sometimes they finish a little late and the blasting would go on until the 6 o'clock hour. And other times when they had some delays, they would actually shoot off some charges in the morning, but that was very few. Down at the bottom, this part shows the distribution of blast events by working level in the mine. And the nice thing about this study was we captured one event on the 1300 level, which is pretty much directed at Site 3. It's actually visible from Site 3. That was one of the new portals. We captured 12 events on the 1200 level, which is a new portal. And we captured over 50 events on the 900 and the 1100 levels, which those are the biggest, longest working levels that we're working on in the underground off the string beam decline. And we also captured some events that deal with some drift mining and also some raise mining. So we were successful at capturing a wide range of activities and locations underground for blasting. This is just a summary of the blast results, and we have the results for the mine at Site A, Amador City at Sites 1, 2, and 3, and Sutter Creek at Site 4. The top row shows the relative distances from the mine workings, from primarily the string beam portal. Site A is actually about 220 feet right outside the portal. And basically what you see here is that 67% of the events were loud enough to be felt and heard at the on-site station, and the other sites could feel between 30 and 47% of the events. The highest levels recorded off-site were 107 dBL, and the lowest levels recorded off-site were 83 dBL. And again, our on-site or project boundary limit is 133 dBL. This 134 is actually within our property. It's not at the project boundary, so that's several hundred feet further away. Next slide. I put this one in just to kind of put the next few slides in perspective, and basically this is the typical A-weighted or DBA scale, and it kind of gives you an idea of the relative order of magnitude or comparison for different levels. So you can see down here that 40 dBL is a typical background level in a residence. 70 dBL is about the noise level that you'd be exposed to if you're in the cab of a commercial airliner while flying. 80 is a diesel locomotive at 300 feet. And 90 is a bulldozer at 50 feet away. and 100 is a shotgun at approximately a distance of 200 feet. So if you keep those in mind when we go through the next slides, it just sort of serves as a reference. So one of the things that the consultant did was they picked a typical day to kind of show the pattern of sound distribution. And the day that they picked was not the loudest, it wasn't the quietest, but it was a day where at 5 p.m. there was a blast that was very noticeable at the, and this is Site A, so this is at the mine site. And what you have here is on the left-hand side for all these slides is that's the sound level expressed in dBA. And across the bottom here is the time of day going from 12 a.m. to 12 p.m., or excuse me, to 11 p.m. The red line is the peak or the maximum level, and the blue line is the average level recorded during the period of the day. So here you see a good signature on that 5 o'clock blast event, and it's about 90 dBA, and that's about the level of a, I think that was the bulldozer at 50 feet. Next slide. Pardon?
And that was the bulldozer.
That was the bulldozer. Thank you.
Question on that, Mr. Cochran, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
These are all, I'm showing like dBA. Is there any chart that show like a dBL? Would that be pertinent?
We showed the maximum dBLs in that chart before.
Okay.
What we're trying to do is with these slides, what they're trying to do is show how it relates to ambient noise and the levels that people are exposed to on a day-to-day basis.
Okay.
So they're trying to put it in perspective. So basically, earlier I showed the dBL readings and showed that the peak at each site was lower than what's allowable at our project boundary during the daytime. And then what these are is to try and put in perspective a comparison, if you will, between ambient noise levels and the effects of blasting.
Sure.
That chart you showed previously, and you don't have to go back to it, but where you talked about what is the noise loudness ratio relative to, that only applies to, because you're talking about loudness, only applies to dBA then. What I'm trying to do is see if, is the rating for dBL, where you're talking, let's say 83 to 130, is that the same relative scale for dBL as it is for dBA?
No, and you see, basically, with dBA, it's what's audible. And so dBL, a diesel locomotive going by will create some pressures that you'll feel with the gust of wind. As the locomotive passes, a bulldozer doesn't create that. So really, from a human hearing or perception standpoint, what we're looking at is the dBA, not the dBL in this case.
Now, there is a vibration. If you're standing too close to something that's creating that much noise, there might be vibration caused. So there could be dBL there, I guess, right?
Well, there's a ground vibration, too, as a locomotive goes by or even a bulldozer does its work. You can feel a ground vibration, which you would record with a seismograph. But generally, the sound that that equipment makes is primarily in the dBA range.
So
it doesn't have that low frequency content like a blast does.
dBA and dBL, their scales have to be looked at independently then, the scales of measurement?
Well, many instruments normally will record just the dBA scale. We record both dBL and dBA. So we can record the effect of that overpressure. And I think last time we showed that the maximum overpressure in that low frequency content was basically at our project boundary was equivalent to about a 19 mile per hour gust of wind. This is a comparison, if you will, to kind of compare the audible component with ambient noise levels versus that subaudible component.
So what I'm trying to figure out, Mr. Cochran, is like Supervisor Forrester, I think, was trying to say is, if you had a scale of both, okay, like you have centigrade versus Fahrenheit, is there any area where those two scales would be perpendicular across from each other, regard to noise and vibration?
Not vibration. Vibration's a separate thing, and those waves travel through the earth.
Okay, so then noise. You were talking about a locomotive and you were talking about a bulldozer. You're going to get vibration from both of them. You're going to get noise from both of them, whether they're moving or standing still.
And the vibration is a ground component. It doesn't travel through the air. With the blast, it generates this low-frequency content that travels through the air that the human ear can't hear.
Say it's similar to, like, if you're standing along a road and a diesel truck goes by, and all of a sudden you get that blast of wind?
You'll feel that blast of wind, but it's not because of the noise that the truck makes.
Isn't that like an air overpressure blast or similar effect?
And, in fact, if you stood there and witnessed the blast on site, you could feel the blast, and you could actually feel that gust.
Air displacement?
Yes. Basically a change in air pressure that you can't hear but you can feel versus the higher frequency content that you can actually hear.
So is there anything in regards to the question I asked you in regards to the graft?
You know, that's a good question, and I asked our noise consultant that question, and basically he said that there's a formula, but it's frequency content dependent. So you have to know the frequency content of your DBL reading, and then you can, there's a formula to calculate the equivalent DBA. DBL is much higher than DBA, so it actually, when you use that formula, it actually reduces the DBA level to, or the DBL to a DBA that's maybe, I think he said for 15 hertz, for example, it might be 40 or a reduction factor of 40 to 50. So, for example, if you had, like we had the peak numbers of 107, you might, for DBL, if the frequency content were 15 hertz, your corresponding DBA would be something on the order of 60 to 70, maybe.
So there is a correlation between DBL and DBA, but your consultant said that it would actually cause a reduction in the overall measurement.
Yes.
Yeah, all the monitoring results at the various sites are measured in DBL. But all of these comparisons that you're throwing out, bulldozers and shotguns, are in DBA. So
I guess we're looking for that.
So basically they do, their instruments recorded both DBL and DBA, and then they looked at the DBL and concluded that the highest DBL level was 107, which is below our allowable limit, and then they looked at the DBA component, which is the audible component, to see how that compared also. So they looked at both scales, if you will, to see what type of effects people were experiencing, as well as what types of effects you would experience at our mine site.
Okay.
You know, something I'm kind of confused on, not to take up too much time, but maybe you explain it to me a little bit. It's kind of, it's almost counterintuitive. I had some information I was looking at. It talks about, in most cases, the atmosphere selectively absorbs a higher frequency from a blast, leaving relatively low-energy 5 hertz sound waves to affect structures. which would seem contrary to what we're looking at the highest levels out there, and it's almost saying that the lower levels are what will affect the structure. If a structure has a natural vibration frequency around 5 hertz, it will respond to the air overpressure by producing higher frequency secondary noise on internal walls. It is this response from the middle of flat walls and structure which causes much of the secondary rattling noise and other observed effects such as movement of pictures, clocks, etc. The question I have is, it's talking about the lower hertz sound waves affecting the homes. Is that correct?
Basically, the lower frequency content will affect the structure, and it's going to, the what you'll experience is not unlike a gust of wind. And what we showed previously was that those low frequency waves at our project boundary, when we measured them back in December, the maximum level was the equivalent of a 19 mile per hour gust of wind.
Okay.
So we do,
so we have measured
record
that,
those, and then the numbers that we recorded in this study, the maximum in Amador City, was 107. 133 dBL is what's allowed for daytime blasting in our permit, and 150 is what it takes to cause structural damage.
That's dBL, though.
Yeah.
So we're considerably below, because it's a logarithmic scale. It's not a linear scale. It's much like the earthquake magnitude scale, where there's much more energy released as you go up from a magnitude 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8. It's not, you know, a direct linear scale.
Some of the residents said, though, that it felt more like a freight train going right next to their house rather than a 19-mile-an-hour wind. So what would account for that? Just the air over pressure, but it, you know, I'm trying to figure out the difference between what you're saying with a 19-mile-per-hour wind and the effect that some of them had when the house appeared to be shaking.
Well, part of it is just there's a broad spectrum of human response. I've talked to other folks in Amador City that said they hadn't heard or felt anything out of the ordinary. And so some of it, and we talked about this last time, has to do with human perception. What they're doing at the time, whether they're walking, standing, sitting, working, sleeping, it has to do with the structure and the quality of the structure and how it responds, what the orientation of the structure is, and then also what we said last time was under certain atmospheric conditions, it can actually cause the waves to basically be focused and be felt more intensely at distance from the site. So if you have an inversion layer, the waves that would normally just travel and come down, actually some of them travel and come down and some of them go up and bounce off and come down. And so they can tend to concentrate and seem stronger than they really are. This focusing, though, occurs in the winter time when you have either temperature or wind inversions, typically, and when you have high humidity. So December was a very, very wet month.
Maybe we better let you finish up your presentation, and then we can get to a public comment also.
Okay. So basically, these next few slides just show at the other locations the same information. They show dBA, time of day. You've got the average recorded level in blue and the maximum in red. And you can see here that 5 o'clock event at site 1, which is about 5,700 feet away, really didn't record at that site. It didn't have a marked peak like I showed you at our site. And you can see that the level here is much lower than some of the other events that occurred during the day that are part of the ambient noise. You can see that things are much quieter up until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. During the day, they get louder, and then they taper off at nighttime. This is at Site 2, which is about 4,100 feet away, and you can see that there is, again, the ambient noise levels get up to about 80 dBA, and the blast that occurred at 5 o'clock, the levels associated with that are about 60 dBA. And again, you see that same pattern where it's relatively quiet. In the early morning hours, it gets louder in the daytime, and then it gets quiet again at night. Site three is the farthest site away. It's 6,200 feet away, and it's up on a hillside. And one of the challenges that the consultant had here was this site receives afternoon winds and winds that are a little bit different than the other sites. But you can see that there's a very distinct peak here of that 5 o'clock blast. It recorded very well. It's below 80 dBA, and it's a little bit lower on this day than some of the other events that occurred. This site is not nearly as smooth in the evening and early morning as the other sites were, so there's some other activity, and the consultant said that it was primarily wind. But there's other things going on. People might be working. You might have a garbage truck. You could have chainsaws, leaf blowers, tractors, all kinds of things. It could dogs barking, things like that, that cause those other events. This is Site 4, so this is the one site in Sutter Creek, and you can see there's a distinct event. It's a little bit quieter than the loudest event of the day, and you can see that this site also gets quite a bit of noise in the background. And I'm not sure what that is, whether it's wind or it's also right above the old highway, so it could be some traffic there. And this is just a slide that sort of summarizes for that same day, February 19th, the comparison of ambient and blasting A-weighted sound levels. So the A-weighted levels associated with our blasting are shown in blue. And the so this is the maximum measured, and in red, that's the maximum measured for ambient or background noise levels. And the point of this is that we're not denying that people hear our blasts. We're not denying that sometimes they actually will feel that low-frequency content. What we're saying is we're in compliance with our permit. Our levels are below levels that could cause structural damage at all locations, including at our mine site, and that in many cases, the levels that we're creating with our blasting are actually below some of the louder ambient noise levels from other sources, which we don't know what those are because we didn't keep track of those. And that's it.
Any further questions before we go to public comment?
Those ambient levels that you referenced there in that last slide, were those recorded recently, or were those levels recorded from a baseline study?
No, all that data on the last slide and the four slides or five slides before that are all, we picked one day, or the consultant picked a day, February 19th. And then they took the maximum blasting level, and they took the maximum ambient level and compared it for that day. With all the days and all the data, there's a tremendous volume of material to go through, and we could be here for days or
where weeks. Was that monitoring site that those were recorded?
That was at each of the locations, so it was each of the off-site locations. So
sites
1, 2, and 3 in Amador City, and Site 4 in Sutter Creek.
Supervisor. Mr. Cochran, sir, if we are blasting
then I take it we are mining, correct?
Pardon?
If we are blasting, then I take it we are mining, correct?
Right now, we're not actually mining, and we're actually not doing any blasting.
Okay, when we were, but...
But we were back then. We were doing what's called underground development, which is basically developing the underground infrastructure or mine workings, if you will, that we need to have in place to access the ore body so that we can begin mining and to provide secondary escape ways so that we can legally mine under federal Mine Safety and Health Administration rules.
Okay, hearing your statement just now in regards to mining, are we still reaching out to the locals to fill those jobs?
Yes, we are. Right now, we don't have any positions open, and we're actually went out to bid on the next phase of underground development, and we sent the request for bids out to a number of contractors, including the contractor who's been working on site, who is a local contractor, as well as another contractor from the Grass Valley area.
Okay, this Ballard consultant, how many local people work for them in their contract with you?
I don't know where those folks live. Ballard is based in the Loomis area, I believe, so he's up in Placer County. He's got sort of a niche business where there aren't a lot of them. I think the county came up with two that were in the general area and do the typical noise consulting studies like we're talking about.
Okay, I just want to make sure that if we do go back to blasting or mining or doing anything out there, that we you hear what this board has told you before in the past, that we try to get local residents or local people from Amador County a job.
We understand that.
Okay. All right.
Back to the issue here is when will the blasting resume, your estimate?
I'm not sure right now. We're evaluating bids. Once we select a contractor, we need to negotiate the contract, and they need to mobilize equipment and the workforce to begin that process. And I don't have a timeline for that right now.
You, as far as monitoring, do you feel you've met your obligation, or will that continue in the future?
We will continue with our on-site monitoring program. That's ongoing. With respect to the off-site program, this specific program was a program that we volunteer to do. It's not specifically required in the permit. It's required that we investigate complaints, and I think the consultant did an adequate job investigating the complaints and generated a wealth of data to determine what sorts of sound levels and air overpressures people both in Amador City and Sutter Creek are being exposed to with our mining or our mine development activities. I will comment that as we progress, we get deeper underground and things become quieter and quieter and quieter. But the loudest events in this study were on the 1100 level. We had a blast when the supervisors came out to visit and the mayors, and it was on the 900 level, and one of them commented that, and I think county staff was there too, that it was sort of a non-event, that you really couldn't feel it. As we get to mining, we're going to be mining much narrower veins, so right now we're developing maybe 8 feet by 8 feet high. So that's the volume of rock going back us about 6 feet. When we get into the stope mining, that might only be 3 feet wide and 8 feet tall going back about 6 feet. So you don't need as much explosives. And in fact, we want to use less then, because if we blast down extra stuff, it dilutes our ore grade. And our goal is to be economically viable, and to do that you've got to minimize your dilution of your ore, so you want to very carefully control those blasts. So things should continue to get quieter, both with the warming temperatures and also the advancing of the development underground.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Cochran. At this time, I'll take public comments. Could please come on up, sign in, and state your name for the record. Susan?
Bragg said Amador City, it did improve a lot, the noise, so I commend them. But I want to mention that the measurement started after we all complained, so the really loud blasting wasn't measured. And it seems like maybe they should have a monitor there all the time, except maybe it's over. So I don't know. But it's a shame the first ones weren't measured. They were really loud, and some people's houses, my house didn't shake, but some did. But there were no measurements at that time.
I believe they do have on-site monitors, have continuously had on-site monitors to measure the blast effects.
Okay.
So I would think that's probably, Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, are those that information, is it public information that the county receives from them? Is it accessible to the public? Like the noise, like basically the blast logs?
Susan Grohada, planning director. I'd have to double check the condition, but I believe, yes, they are not routinely turned into us, but they are available in the event. And that's, I believe that's what some of this information has been derived from, was from their monitoring, their ongoing monitoring.
So if a person's concerned about that December time period, there should have been a monitor on site to monitor the noise levels.
On the on-site monitoring.
Yeah, and I would think that you could probably ask the mine to look at that information.
You could ask Mr. Cochran to speak to that. He has, I believe they have the information from the monitoring at that time, correct?
And from each blast event.
Yeah, we included a summary of that information in our presentation to the board on January 8th, and we also provided county staff with a log of all blast events from 2012, which go back to about the third week in September when we began blasting.
So that would include that December time frame. There seems to be some concern.
Yes, those records are available, and our use permit requires that we continue to record at our project boundary stations, and we have brand new instruments calibrated at the factory, and we record those levels, and the contractor reports to us the blast information in terms of times a day. And I believe what we gave the county was actually a spreadsheet, if you will, that basically had the contractor's information on the time that they set off the blast. It had the results from our monitoring stations, and it also had the complaints that county received or that we received directly in their all-in-one worksheet. And I assume since we gave that to planning department that is available to the public.
Okay. As far as Ms. Bragg says, comments, though, I'd like to go back in time, too, and be able to capture those events that occurred. But unfortunately, that's not possible with the way government moves, and we went about as fast as we could.
Well,
the point is they were captured by the on-site monitoring,
on-site.
But the off-site monitoring wasn't in place, and I think that's what Susan Bragg says.
That's right. But unfortunately, we can't go back in time and recreate that. I don't think anybody would want to recreate it.
Yeah.
I think to Susan's point, Ms. Bragg says, is that the real value of our monitoring is going to have a known place where county residents can call when they experience a blast event, noise, vibration, whatever it is, and call and report that so that then we can compare that to the logged events at the mine site and draw a correlation between the two, saying, yes, you did feel something, and it coincides with our data at the site that says, well, this one was a little bigger than most, and you start to establish some sort of relevance between the effects that the community feels and the blast data recorded at every blast event at the site. But it's incumbent upon people calling up and saying, hey, there was one today, it shook my windows, and I want it documented.
I think one thing where Mr. Cochran was saying there could be an anomalies is if you have those atmospheric events and, say, at the mine site, you may not have that high of a reading, but then, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like what you're saying, theoretically, if you had those the sound waves bouncing off the clouds or ever coming down and focusing like you're talking about, you might get a higher reading than you're a mile away than you would at the mine site.
So recordation of the weather conditions would also be a component of that monitoring.
Yeah, and I don't know they'd necessarily be higher than at the mine site, but it's higher than it would be if the sound propagated the way, or the air overpressures propagated the way they would normally propagate.
Okay.
Because basically you get that reflection as well as the normal travel, so they tend to increase what would the felt effects above what would normally be felt. And again, those conditions occur in the winter months, at least in the northern hemisphere, when it's cold and wet, or when there's wind shear. So either thermal inversions or temperature inversions, or in wind shear inversions, and also when there's cold temperatures and high humidity, there's less resistance to the waves to begin with. So it's sort of that culmination of factors that come into play. Unfortunately for our study, we didn't have really wet events in January, so we actually extended the study through February, hoping that we'd capture more of those storm events, but as you know, and we talked about, you know, we could all use more rain, that we've had a very dry year, and a wet December, but dry January, February, and March, and April, actually. So it would have been great if we would have had some of those weather events, but we just didn't.
Well, thank you.
All right. More public comments? My name is Farmer. Very good.
Down here. Frances Farmer, Amador City. And first, I'd like to thank all of you for taking the time to listen to us, and also to Setter Gold for all the time and effort they put in with the consultant to get the information. I've got some isolated points, and then I have a major question. Possibly Mr. Cochran can address it, and I think some of you have touched on it today as well. In isolation, and this is a bit repetitive, but there have been some comments about going back. We didn't complain any sooner because we didn't know we could, so the fact they started getting complaints September-ish, October-ish, was that's when we found out there was a place to call. And a person would like even to see the mine records for that December night that shook so many of us, just to see what they monitored at that site, because I know we didn't have anything in place at our homes. And in talking about the overpressure, we are down there in the creek, some of us that really feel things, and that creek reverberates. You can talk at one end of the creek and you don't know it, but people at the other end can hear what you're saying if you're talking it all loudly. So that, with the atmospheric conditions, might actually affect us more. And I don't really know. I'm obviously not an expert in any of this, but that could have something to do with it. And as was pointed out, we didn't have enough wet weather when we monitored to really document whether that's true or not. Regarding the ambient noise, just a little comment, February was dry, and so that particular day we could have all been out with our leaf blowers if we'd had wind or with some equipment because we had a mowing lawn or something. So one day showing a lot of loud ambient noise, I don't know that that's very useful. Otherwise, I'm struggling, I think, as some of you are, to understand some of the noise levels, because I'm more familiar with Cal OSHA, whose levels for noise, if you're working, are 85 to about 130, but that's a consistent noise and it's measured differently. And if you do work under those conditions, then you have to have ear protection, ear hearing tests, and some of that sort of thing. And it is a different measurement. I think if I understand correctly, the measurement of the decibel is more a measurement of volume and less a measurement of something that's high-pitched, like working around a table saw or other equipment that's going to like hurt your ears or do hearing damage. And then I remember years ago when I worked up at Fallen Leaf on the lake that we had some decibel requirements for boats. And again, I think that relates more to ongoing hearing than it does what is being referred to here. So that's something to consider and figure out. And then what I don't really understand, I've done some reading, and some of the literature is very technical for me, so it wasn't very helpful. But I've read a number of articles about mining and blasting. And yes, they talk about noise, which is what we hear. And yes, they talk about the effects of the pressure, the over-air pressure, so you feel a wind. But every single article, and I cannot find one that does not, talks about ground vibrations. And yet I keep hearing that negated by Sutter Gold, and I don't understand. And it was commented this morning that the vibrations are measured seismically. But I have an article here that says that it's not measured in seismic velocity, but it's particle velocity. Now, not being an expert in this area, I'm not sure what particle velocity is, but that is caused apparently by blasting, according to several articles that I've read, and it can be measured, but it's measured with something called a velocity transducer, a geophone, and so you can record the ground vibrations. And I do agree with what was said today from what I've read about the air pressure. It does have to be way over 120 to cause damage. It'll rattle your windows, it'll shake your pots and pans if your door is open or whatever, but the air vibration does not apparently cause damage, but ground vibrations do. And the lower the measurement, the bigger the wave, the more damage. And again, that's very unscientific because I'm struggling to understand it. So I don't know why we aren't giving more attention to something coming through the ground when all these articles about mining blasting talk about that. And even when you do oil, you're exploring for oil, you blast on the surface, and then depending on what kind of a vibration you get back from the ground, you know if you have oil on the ground or if you've got rock or some other material that vibrates differently. So I'm just not understanding that, and I'm concerned because I did have considerable cracks. I don't have any more. Since January, it has been a lot quieter. Thought we were out of the woods completely because it's been very quiet, and then found out they haven't been blasting at all, so that's why it is quiet. But since we complained, it has been much better. So some steps were taken to reduce the amount of explosive or to do whatever you can do. It's much appreciated because it was much better, and the cracks didn't increase after we came in and complained. So thank you.
Possibly we can have Mr. Cochran comment on that just so that we can get some of the questions, at least try to answer some of the questions before people bring up new questions or related questions. Mr. Cochran, do you have any comments on the ground vibration and measuring that?
Is there anybody from Ballard here? Either?
As part of our blast monitoring program, our on-site program that's required in our permit, we do measure ground vibrations as well as air overpressures and the higher frequency content of the noise or the sound, basically. So last time we talked about ground vibrations, and basically the ground vibrations radiate out from the blast site and they reduce in magnitude. And the analogy that we used was it was a lot like if you had a pool of water or a lake or a pond and you threw a stone into it, you would see the waves radiate out, and that's much how the ground vibrations radiate out. We monitor those, and they move about, depending on conditions and the type of rock, 2,500 to 7,200 feet per second. And so whereas sound travels at a relatively uniform speed, so the ground vibrations that we measure, we use portable seismographs at each of our monitoring stations. So our on-site stations include a seismograph or geophones, basically, and they measure peak particle velocity. And then we also have the measurements of the air overpressures, too. And those measurements that we've recorded are so low at our property boundary that it's not scientifically possible for them to propagate to Sutter Creek or Amador City at levels that could cause damage. So we are in compliance with our allowable vibration levels at our project boundary, and scientifically, we can't get them to be higher, especially high enough to cause damage off-site at distances of 41 to 6,200 feet from our property. The earthquakes that we have really have these seismic waves, and those are much more energy than we put into the ground with a blast. So the seismograph is a measure of the amount of acceleration, which is a function of the size of the blast, and an earthquake releases so much more energy than ours. But we can pick those up, and I believe we actually did record one earthquake with our, at least one earthquake with our seismographic stations. And we continue to do that. That's part of our ongoing program.
Bruce Torrey. Morning.
Les Bruce Torrey. I realize that the Ballard Consultant Group are the experts here, but I do have some questions on the information that was presented, and some of this is going to be redundant. It's already been covered, but I'd like to cover it anyway, just for the record, if you will. If you look on page 15 of this presentation, it said that the middle bullet point, the highest record sound levels in Emmer County occurred during periods of both cold temperatures and high relative humidity. Further down in the body, it says, January and February monitoring period likely represents worst case. I have to challenge that statement from the standpoint, as we already talked about, this January and February was one of the seasonably warmest, driest January, Februarys we've had for quite a while. And to be specific to that, we had less than a half an inch of rain in that time period between the beginning and the end of their study. We had less than a half an inch of rain. And so, based on their presentation in January, and Dave has already indicated that the winter months can focus the air overpressures because of the atmospheric conditions, the pressures, and everything else. And so, I guess to that bullet point, I doubt we've seen or documented the worst case scenario. You know, to me, it would be more like, let's take a look at maybe in November, December, or some other time period that we had some rain, had some very cold weather to do our benchmarking. So that would be one item. Next one is on page 11 of the presentation. The third bullet point down is because peak overpressures below 83 decibels were too low to register on our sound level meters. That's very concerning that their meters won't pick up 83 decibels. If you look at their presentation on January, it said that 70 decibels was distinctly perceptible and 90 was strongly perceptible. And so if these meters that they had on this study that they just conducted wouldn't pick up 80, I don't know that we have the right type of equipment monitoring this what we're trying to monitor here. And I would just say that maybe, you know, there's been beating around a lot here as far as decibels and deviated, whatever. But if it's not picking up 83 and 70 is distinctively perceptible on their own data, I think we've got a problem there. And then my biggest concern is on page 14, the last sentence on page 14, which states, a higher nighttime threshold of significance for blasting overpressure could be accommodated without resulting in significant adverse noise impacts on nearby residents. Wow. I don't know that we have all the information to do that, because today their lower limit, or excuse me, their upper limit is 60 decibels. Okay, and again, based on their own information, 70 is distinctly perceptible and 90 is strongly. I don't know that we have all the information to make a good decision here. And the data that was generated from this study was done in the mildest winter we've had in a long time. And they're considering, I don't know why that statement's in there, but there seems to me there's some kind of indication that there may be a desire to increase the limits in nighttime. And that concerns me, being a resident and having additional noise at night. And so I guess I would just request from the board that any future request to increase the nighttime limits be seriously considered before we do that. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
I have the exact same comment underlined in my notes with a notation next to that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Pleasant.
Any other public comments? Farmer.
Just a question, since apparently there are some ground vibration statistics available. Would they be available to the public? Because the one article that I have did list results that would cause structural damage. So it would be interesting to see what they come up with at the mine site, at least for me, just out of curiosity, to compare it to what I'm reading.
Susan, are those statistics kept at the mine available for the general public?
If I have them, they're available. Yes, and I do have, Mr. Cochran said, I do have the information that they provided us, which I believe included, it wasn't September and October, I think it was just November, December.
That we get report. Report that included.
Right, but what, from which month?
September.
It's the whole period? Okay, so, yeah, I have it, if somebody would like to have it.
Right.
And as far as, continuing to call the county with, I say, complaints or observations on blasting, that is something that is still available to everyone. That's part of the process. So if there is an unusual event, please let us know. And the on-site monitoring equipment will be in place. As Mr. Cochran said, that is something that they're required to do, to have maintain the on-site monitoring. So there can be a review of the data that's available.
Mr. Cochran, would you like to address any of those comments that were made? Specifically, I guess, regarding the presentation that was made in December and the 70 dB and 90 dB.
Yeah, I have two comments. One, we can't control the weather. I wish we could. I think what the consultant was trying to say was December, January, February, and March are typically the wettest and the coolest times of the year. We do have on-site data that captured the December. We're not required to monitor off-site in our permit. The restrictions apply at our project boundary, and we continue to monitor that as required. We couldn't control the weather in January or February, and like I said, it would have been nice if we would have had a really wet time of year where we could record some of those events. We did have some events in that we were able to see. There seemed to be, as we said, we expect, there seemed to be higher levels recorded off-site when it's wet and when it's cold. We just didn't have as much moisture in February and January as we'd hoped.
What about the comments Mr. Bruce Torrey made relative to the 70 and the 90 being distinctly noticeable, and the why measurements in this level appear to look at it a little differently?
Yeah, with respect to the instruments that we use and that the consultant used, we have brand new state-of-the-art equipment, and it has a lower threshold. For DBL, we can read down to that 83 DBL, and that's just, we're not the equipment manufacturers. And we went out into the marketplace and look for instruments, and the consultant has state-of-the-art equipment too, and that's just a function of what's out there in the marketplace. We don't have control over that.
Yes, so in regards to that, are there any other mining companies that you know of or that maybe this consultant knows that uses different type of equipment than you or the consultant are using?
Let me ask, I've got a mining engineer here who does our noise, our monitoring program. Dr. Gates. This is John Gates. He's an associate mining engineer. He's was born and raised here. Went to University of Nevada, Reno, and he is in charge of maintaining and keeping records for our blast monitoring program on site.
Yes, sir. If you could sign in for the record, please. Are you Mr. Gates from Ridge Road?
Got it.
I thought you looked familiar. I haven't seen you in many years.
I still hide around town. John Gates, associate mining engineer for Sutter Gold Mining Company. The equipment that we use is the specific brand we use is the most commonly used seismograph. Instant Tell makes there's multiple brands out there, but that is the one that's most commonly used. And the Minimate Blastmate that we use is at thousands of mines and used by thousands of blast consultants.
Are those devices the ones measuring DBL or
DBL
vibrations?
And vibration. It's
both.
Got two components to it. So it's got a geophone that has spikes that goes into the ground, monitors the peak particle velocities in all three directions, and takes that maximum and reports it to us. The threshold for damage that you usually see would be over a half inch to 2 inch per second for peak particle velocities. Our units measure vibrations down to 0.01, and we can't even get triggers on a majority of the blasts at that very, very low level. It's just there's not enough energy from our blasting to actually shake it enough to record. Like David said, when there is a blast vibration, it triggers the geophone before it triggers the velocity is faster for ground vibration. So it's going to get to that unit first before the noise does. So it triggers the unit, tells it, hey, we've got a reading, let's record, and it turns the microphone on, and the microphone tries to record the sound. If it's loud enough, has enough pressure to record the DBL, 83 DBL is completely imperceptible. It's such a low velocity compared to, like, wind.
That apparently isn't what your presentation in January said.
DBA, right now, we're at, you know, 48 DBA. You can hear it. Your ears are very, very sensitive. You can hear that at a higher frequency. But at 15 hertz, at a real low frequency, you can't hear it. And the equipment can't record it. There's just not enough pressure there to be able to record below 83 decibels DBL. But you can record below 83 A. It's a higher frequency. You can record it at lower, lower, lower levels. So we're at 20,000 hertz right now talking. You're not going to hear 15 hertz, which is where the sound pressure is for our blasts. That was kind of the point of showing DBL and DBA. DBA is what people are hearing, just like an airplane flies overhead. You hear it, and you know what that sound is, but it's not necessarily loud enough to concern you. If I can say, hey, a plane just flew by, as opposed to a jet flew by and it rattled my windows, that rattling of your windows is going to be a DBL measurement. That's going to be sub-audible. That's what's actually shaking your windows, and that's what's bothering you. That's where, your complaints are legitimate, if that helps.
Is that your response to Mr. Brusatori's specific comments that the January presentation said that 70 and 90 dBLs were both noticeable and strongly, I can't remember the exact language.
I'm not sure, but I'd say that there's probably a mix-up between
is measured in DBL, says that 70 is distinctly perceptible and 90 dBL is strongly perceptible, and yet your measuring devices won't measure anything below 83.
Now, if you look at these PSIs, the actual pressure, you look at all those zeros.
I'm trying to stay with a consistent unit of measure here, whether it's dBL, dBA, pressure, speed of travel of the sound or the vibrations. Heard presentations on.
So, looking at that quickly, can you make any sense of it?
No, I can't. In fact, I'd have to look where these.
Oh, was your presentation
came from on the
thing
right?
The thing is, are we looking at two separate?
It might have been a mix-up between dBA and dBL. When you look at the PSI between the one that says 7.2 mile per hour wind gust, there's three zeros before the 9.2, and when you go down to 70 dBL, it's you're talking 1/10,000th of the energy compared to a 7 mile per hour wind gust. To me, it doesn't make any sense. I'd have to look at where this came from. But what's distinctly perceptible? I'm not sure what that means, strongly perceptible. I'm thinking it might have been a mix-up between DBL and DBA, honestly.
All is pretty technical. It might be a good idea, Mr. Cochran, if we had some kind of feedback on this discussion of what was presented in December and what's being presented today. It might explain or help to explain what was said in December or what was presented to us and why it's different than today.
I'd have to go back and look up the reference for the source of this chart. And I think what John was trying to say is at 110, that's about a 7.2 mile an hour gust of wind, and it's a logarithmic scale. Perceptibility is you'll see that it's an average human response, and this is that thing that I mentioned earlier where although it might be perceptible, it's not necessarily uniformly perceptible.
I think we'd like to get some feedback, though, written so everyone can see it, because I want to make sure we're talking apples to apples. If what was said in December was an apple and what's being presented today is an orange, then they're not going to have a correlation. So it'd be nice to have some feedback once you look at the documentation.
Okay. And so you'd like a letter from us, or?
I think that'd be good, just a simple couple paragraphs explaining.
Mr. Chairman, I think something that might be helpful, too, is to, we hired the expert or the consultant to prepare this survey. This is their business. I would much rather be listening to a disinterested, objective source of this information and how it all correlates to each other and the kind of complaints and effects that the public feels from Ballard Acoustical Consultants. Seems to me that we should be asking them to make a presentation on this and how these different measuring units of measure correlate.
The information presented in December was from Sutter Goldbine.
Right.
And the information presented today is from your consultant. So is your question then to have the consultant?
Well, but it's being presented. It's being presented by Sutter Goldmine today, and it seems like we're all kind of confused here between DBLs and DBAs and a whole host of things. So
I think I got a pretty good handle on it. It's just what was presented in December is what confuses it now. Is that talking about the 70 and the 90? So are we talking apples to apples? So whether you have an independent consultant comment on this or choose to do it yourself, that I would just like to get some kind of comment on it.
And our desire was to have the consultant present his own report. You have his report. Unfortunately, his schedule was such that beginning the middle of April, he's very busy. I spoke with him yesterday, and he had a prior commitment that he confirmed he had to attend, and he couldn't be here. So the best we could do was to wrap up his study, get the report from him, and he's working on another project. We could arrange some time that he could come back and talk with you if that's what your desire is.
Well, to get, maybe that would be a time to address the difference that we have here between what was presented in December and today. Maybe the consultant could come back and discuss that area too. Frankly, my concern more with the future is, even though you're going to be at deeper ground levels, is there a chance that once we hit the cold weather again and you get those same atmospheric conditions of cold weather and high humidity, is there still a chance to have the same type of events that occurred in December come back on us? It's a long ways off, and looking at a crystal ball, who knows? But don't know if it's cost prohibitive to install more measurement monitoring devices at that time, or if you even feel it would be needed because you're going to be at such deep ground levels.
Well, I believe there's sufficient data to show that in terms of on-site ground vibrations and on-site air overpressures that were in compliance with our permit and the levels of that we're generating in terms of ground vibrations and air overpressures are consistent with our permit, and they're not sufficiently high to cause damage to structures at our project boundary. In addition, the off-site monitoring of the air overpressures confirmed what we told you back in January, that although they are experiencing, we're not in denial that they're experiencing air overpressures and sound from our blasting, but it's below levels that are allowed at our property boundary, and it's also at levels below any that would cause any damage to structures.
Maybe 100%.
That's not to say people cannot feel them and perceive them and be annoyed by them, but the other thing is that they are a very small spectrum. As the consultant's report indicated, 0.4% of the time intervals that were measured contained blast effects.
I think you're 100% correct in what you're saying. The problem is we didn't have the monitoring devices, as Ms. Bragg said, in place in December when how many events were there? 18 events?
I forget what the number was.
But we didn't have the monitoring devices in place at that time. I'm just looking at for your own protection. If you're blasting again in December when we have more of a typical winter, in December, January, then you'd be looking at, if you're blasting, you'd be looking at the situation and being able to respond if those same complaints come in. Get that typical high humidity, cold weather. But that's something to look at down the road, I guess.
And it's possible. There, like we said in January, there's no doubt that they experienced some effects. It was a unique seasonal thing. It's possible that it could happen again, even though we'll be at deeper levels in the mine, and when we are actually mining, looking at smaller charges. So it's less likely to occur, but it is possible. Regardless, what we said in January with our on-site data and what the consultant is saying now with regard to air overpressures, it's extremely unlikely. Right now, the data show that they're nowhere near the level that would cause any damage to structures. And it's highly unlikely that we would ever approach that, even with the winter conditions that we had in January, because it's a logarithmic scale. It's not a linear scale.
Any other board questions?
Yeah, you know, a question I'd be kind of curious to know, and is it possible that you could have, say, acceptable readings at the mine site, and as you travel out that you could actually get a higher reading at a further distance than you would at the mine, as far as whether it's DBL or DBA?
I think, and I think I answered this once before, is what we, it's unlikely that we would have a higher reading at a remote location, but it is possible under certain atmospheric conditions that you'll get a higher reading than expected at that location if natural attenuation of those air overpressures and the audible portion occurred.
Yeah, I thought you said that last minute. Memory. I think you said the same thing basically last time. That's kind of unlikely, but not impossible. Because there, I know it's around, I'm not sure it was December when, there's one time I was out in my back deck and I thought maybe your powder magazine, I don't know if you have one, had blown up or something. Because there was, first I thought it was one hell of a big blast of thunder. I thought it wasn't thunder. It was kind of like a, wasn't quite the right day to be having, you know, having like a thunderstorm, but kind of close. And there's no more thunder, no more nothing. I thought, well, my thought was it probably came from the mine. It was a blast, and it was pretty loud. And I'm over, you know, between Drytown and Plymouth, but kind of up in a hill, so it probably traveled across. And I think that's probably the same time period. Some other people had some concerns. I imagine if they were a lot closer than I was, it probably would have been probably got their attention.
And like I said, the studies that I've reviewed all say that this kind of reflection that can occur with inversion layers is typically on the order of a mile to 3 miles away. So if you're in that window, it's possible under the right atmospheric conditions you could be experiencing that, and that's what we believe happened. Was that, you know, we didn't have any unusual blasts that were extremely large, larger than any other ones. It was that unique set of atmospheric conditions that caused those.
You know, I have a question for probably Susan Grahava, if she's wouldn't mind. There's provisions to measure the noise and basically seismic vibrations at the mine site. Is there any provisions to have a monitoring station, pardon me, off-site? Like, say, where we've been having most of the complaints come from?
My recollection is there's no requirement to have off-site monitoring. There is a condition that does say that they will investigate any complaints, which is what is being done under this monitoring.
Yeah, I just think there's a way to do that, and I don't put no more expense in them, but it's just something I think about. Otherwise, we're going to be asking the chicken and egg question for who knows how long. You know, I mean, they'll say on site we had no issues and everything is fine, and you know, you may have people coming in saying, hey, we're experiencing issues, problems, we're unhappy, and with that anomaly of being able to have higher readings, you know, if that won the 3 mile envelope, that's one way you say, hey, you know what, we've done that, and I'm not asking the mine to do that, but I don't know if it's something the county would consider doing on their own. It's something to consider, and this way here, I think we can say, hey, we've dot our I's, crossed our T's. And there's been no events that would cause structural damage, and no issues. And I think that's. Otherwise, we can look at this thing and beat it around the bush 10 different ways a Sunday, and not have a conclusive answer.
Now that's where my
Aaron wants to weigh in here.
That's where my question was going, Supervisor. That I don't expect any problems for the remainder of this year until we get to that same time of year where we have the issues, if we have the same atmospheric conditions. And to me, the sort of gold mine would be protecting themselves to have monitoring in place, and rather than be reactive, be proactive.
Supervisor Aaron Bursatore, Community Development Director. I wanted to clarify what Susan was saying. The condition reads that they have to have on-site monitoring, and they have to have a monitoring device at the nearest receptor. So depending on where they're at in their operations, that there's a device that gets moved to the closest resident. So it's not on site. It gets moved. When they were doing their first part of their blasting, it was at the Brightman's residence. I believe I got that name correct, which is right you know, a couple hundred yards away from the mine entrance. As they got further into their mining operations, they relocated that to the Mormon residence, which is over by the Ice House Reservoir. So that device has been in place since they started their blasting activities back in September. They've had three devices in place, and one of them is roving around to the nearest receptor.
Would it be possible? I mean, maybe if everybody was to amenable to it, we could move out to see, like, whether it's the Bragstad's or Farmer's or maybe, I don't know if you have a conflict here, Brucetori's residence. Different Brucetori, of course. It's a thought.
I think the condition reads it's supposed to be closest to the nearest receptor is how the condition reads. So
yeah, I said if everyone's amenable to it.
If we're bearing away from the nearest receptor, I mean the nearest receptor saying, hey, I want that at my house,
okay,
then there may be a conflict there. If they didn't have a problem with that, then that would be probably could be discussed, but not as the condition's written. It's the closest receptor.
Okay. I think it's something to explore, whether we could do
that. I think we'll continue to talk to Mr. Cochran about this and try and come up for what is best with the public, but I have a couple of members of the public that also like to speak.
I'd also like Mr. Chairman to weigh in here, and we've heard a lot about the conditions of the permit and voluntary conducts of this survey and so forth, but I believe at our last meeting on this topic we did, and maybe Mr. Brucetori can speak to this, there is a condition in the permit that stipulates that if a significant number of community complaints arise, we may have the opportunity to or deem it prudent to look at some of the monitoring or mitigation measures and address some of those. And it seems to me like that's where we're at right now is we've done this monitoring. We've got some data. Was it collected at the optimal time to reflect worst-case scenarios, as the Ballard consultant report shows? Probably not, given our recognition of how dry January and February was. But we've got some data to go off of, and now it's incumbent upon the public, when they have experience a negative effect of blasting, to keep calling, notifying the public or notifying the county that they've felt something, and it's up to us to then correlate all that data and monitor the overall blasting, compare it with the blast records of the mine, and see if we have to open things.
That sounds like the best way to go, but my concern is that hit December again, we're going to have the same atmospheric conditions, and complaints will start coming in, and after the monitoring equipment is put in place, it's going to be too late again to capture those events. So
you're saying you're a proponent of additional off-site monitoring equipment come November next year?
Well, I'm a proponent of the Sutter Gold Mine being proactive and not reactive to this, just to cover their own backside, too.
In person, I wouldn't be a proponent of additional equipment. I'd be advocating saying, hey, the one that's like the Brightman residence or the other one, maybe talk to some of those people, say, you know, would you mind if we move that equipment to a different location? And if they're not having issues, I'd probably give you an affirmative. If it's okay, Sutter Gold and everybody agrees, then we could do that. And I think that'd be no additional expense to Sutter Gold.
Can we hear from Ms. Sandow, Ms. Farmer? You both had your hands up. Sandow, I know you're the silent partner back there.
Frances Farmer, I just had a question for Aaron. When you talk about the nearest and the distance in your moving, how do they measure that? If they're underground in a tunnel, the tunnel might be closer to me than something on the surface. Does that make sense today?
I think that's what Aaron had mentioned, that they moved that closest receptor over to the Sutter Creek side or up by Ice House Reservoir because that was closer to where their blasting was occurring.
I believe it's measured from like a plan view as the crow would fly, where they're at and where it's at, not like a hypotenuse between the elevation versus a distance through the earth. It's measured from...
Mine's charted. They know
like a bird's eye view. Yeah, you take a bird's eye view, you're looking at it's at a map. Here's where we're blasting. This is the nearest receptor to that blast, not to the portal, to where the actual blast in northings and eastings happening, not in elevation.
Okay, so if you're pointing here, and this is the opening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but they're way back in here in a tunnel. My house is here, only they're underground, but they're that close to my house. They're not.
They're going the other way, though.
Well,
so they're
getting,
they're
just,
going further
I'm
south.
I know. I'm just doing this theoretically because there was no room to go that
way
on this podium. So they could be closer to me in the tunnel than here. Is that what you're saying?
In the portal, yeah.
So the blast, the actual blast in the ground could be closer to my house than
the portal.
Then
they would move that to you because you were the closest to that.
Okay, so they would use where they're blasting underground as
correct.
A determinant.
Okay,
that was my question, and I didn't understand that before what you said.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, Ms. Sandow.
I'm Joyce Sandow. I'm site number two. And first of all, I want to thank the Sutter Gold Mine for being such good neighbors. They have done, I think, beyond what I personally expected to have happen. I agree with Mr. Forrester that we need to be very interested to know when the blasts are going to begin again. I, again, would offer my property, which is 4,100 feet from the mine, which seems to be the closest that was used for this measuring. I think myself, personally, I truly believe the sound comes over the hill to the creek and goes down the creek, and it reverberates. I would not be afraid if I knew when their blasts were, when I could expect this. What really made me nervous was in November and December, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know who I should call to complain. Now I know who I call. And if they could give us, those of us that have been affected, a blast time frame, i.e. they're going to do one at 10, one at 1, one at 6, fine. At least I would be prepared. Instead of being in my kitchen and having my pot shake and reverberation under my feet, and I'm thinking, holy cow, what are we doing now? I came from the Bay Area and I've been through far too many earthquakes. So I am very sensitive to when the ground shakes. And I'm on rock. So,
you know, one thing I'd say about earthquakes, Ms. Sandow, is look at all the old loose-stacked walls and the dry-stacked buildings we have. They're all still standing. Not to say you can have an earthquake tomorrow, but it seems like we have real issues is down in the Bay Area. If we had the kind of events they have down there, most of our historical buildings, they wouldn't still be around. So.
Well, all I can say is I was in a few of them that the walls went down, etc. So that made me nervous, not knowing what was going on. If you could inform us of the time frames that you're planning to blast. Now, I know that we waited for, what, an hour and a half when one evening he brought over the equipment to measure the of the earth, wasn't it? Anyway, we waited and waited, and they didn't have the blast that night. It was lovely talking with him for an hour and a half, but it was fruitless. So all I can say is, personally, I would like to know what the blast timing would be so I can be prepared for it.
Well, typically, it sounds like between 4:30 and 6 that you and Ms. Bragg said and Ms. Farmer should go down to the Imperial Hotel and have a couple of pops, and you probably wouldn't worry about it.
You know, that's an idea. But anyway, I just wanted to thank you for being good neighbors because they've really, I think, stepped up to the plate. I didn't move to the country to have my world shaken. If I know when it's coming, I think I could handle it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we've about talked this out today. Mr. Cochran, one more time. I know some suggestions have been made here, and we did talk about you possibly bringing your consultant in once you've looked at these results to address those. Would you be receptive to that?
Yeah, we'd be receptive to that. It's dependent on his other commitments to do that. And with regard to Bandow's comments, typically the contractor who is working on site basically and whoever has the contract in the future, basically what they try to do is blast at end of shift, because after you blast, you have to let the dust settle, so to speak, before it's safe and healthy to reoccupy that area and continue to work. So end of shift is a good time. So that's why the blasts are between 4 and 6 p.m. typically. It doesn't always work that way. I won't tell you what my banker said about mining, but stuff happens. So it, you know, and as she witnessed, you know, we had a time that they thought it was going to go off, and it didn't. So typically it will be at end of shift. There will be some cases where we're going to have to make adjustments. But in the future, we can probably give you an idea of when that's going to occur. But, you know, we can't control what goes on in the underground, how hard the rock is and when they finish. But in the future, we can give a rough idea of what those windows will be. But it's not practicable and it's not feasible to, you know, call out, you know. And in mining, one of the things they do is that they can also, we could get a big loud horn or a bell to notify people when the blast is going to go off, but that kind of
air raid siren.
That kind of, you know, compounds the situation, in my opinion.
There's a couple down in Ione that you could buy cheap from Retro Seco.
So I'll talk with the consultant and see when he can come back. We'll look into that question and we'll try to answer that for you. One question that I have on the notion of off-site noise monitoring, our permit's a little bit dated. It's a good permit. It's a very onerous permit. I wish we didn't have the 100-plus conditions that we have in mitigation measures, but that's my lot in life. I'm just curious, is other projects where you've got blasting going on the surface and those blasts are much larger, if you've approved any projects where you do require off-site monitoring, or is ours typical? I don't have a feel for that, and perhaps the board or staff could.
I think staff probably has more of a background on what kinds of conditions have been placed in the past than we do, just because it spans over a longer period of time.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you're talking about each project is an individual project, and the conditions are approved based on the input that comes in during the public hearing process. So I don't know if it's really relative whether another project has those exact conditions. I mean, unfortunately, Sutter Gold Mine's right in between Amador City and Sutter Creek, so there was a huge concern about the vibrations, about the blasting.
Proximity to population centers. Yeah.
When you come back in the future, it might be good to consider down the road what happens when we get back to those same atmospheric conditions that were present in December and, as you said, are normally present in January and February. So would it be proactive to do some monitoring at that point? So that's a consideration for you for the future. And also, if your consultant could address the differences between what we saw in December and in the report and what we saw today, that would be helpful.
Okay.
But as you also heard, some of your neighbors feel you have been a good neighbor on this, and
I think they're just trying to maintain that relationship.
Thank you for your time today.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, the board's going to take a break. We're about an hour behind where we usually do it, but we'll come back into session just prior to 11:30.